Welcome to the Sum of It All, Bad at Math podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the book, Bad at Math, Dismantling Harmful Beliefs That Hinder Equitable Mathematics Education by Lydia Gonzalez. Transcripts to our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're chatting about Chapter 8, Achievement Gaps or Opportunity Gaps. And Mark, I know that this phrase achievement gap has been around for a very, very long time. It's in a lot of the research, it's in a lot of literature around instruction, especially in the math, like in our lens of the math world. And the idea there for listeners who might be less familiar with it is just this idea of like, we can take any data, usually it's summative data, usually it's tests, usually it's a standardized test of some sort, and we can look and compare different student groups' results to each other. We can essentially disaggregate the data and say, like, what happens? What's different? And, you know, I think it's interesting. The author mentions that the purported goals of such research are to understand the different achievement levels of various groups so that an effort can be made to minimize the gaps. But oftentimes, right, these achievement gaps are almost always polarized as white students and other students. Special education students and other students, right? There's always this group and another. And it really does a number on our mind in terms of how we think about our kids and how we think about their abilities and aptitudes and achievements. So instead, the author's asking us to reframe this idea into an opportunity gap. So maybe you can share a little bit, Mark, about why should we reframe? What's the whole deal with an opportunity gap instead?
Yeah, sure, Audrey. And I think to kick it off, I just want to pull in some of the author's words from page 126. And our author says, one should question whether these efforts are reaching their intended goal, or if what we are measuring is less a matter of the achievement of various groups and individuals and more of a result of the opportunities afforded them. And I just think that that's a great way to sort of start the conversation around this pivot. Audrey, for me, that form of language was in place for much of my career. Is just, it was always this idea of this achievement gap. And it was many years before I heard about the possibility of rephrasing it. But the shift of the language, as our author just mentions, it really has implications for the level of responsibility for this so-called gap. So, you know, with the phrase achievement gap, our minds tend to focus on how the student needs to achieve. And in the past, in my experience, this has been focused on the way that the student is broken and failing and how this gap actually might be their fault. And it's caused by the poor achievement of the student. So this idea of, it's a short trip to the idea that the student has a failed effort. How many times have we heard or even said ourselves, perhaps at one time, somebody needs to try harder, right? It's up to the student to try harder, to pay attention, especially in math class. It's a famous phrase, right? And those are the whys of why a student is achieving, quote unquote, achieving at a certain level, versus that the school or the system has failed to provide the proper supports to provide the opportunity for the student to achieve. One of the things I like about reframing this language is it's something that we have control over. You know, a lot of things that we've been talking about, Audrey, sometimes we can get into that mindset of like, I don't have control over whether we have standardized tests or not.
Sure.
But we do have control over how we take responsibility about improving our learning environment so students have more opportunity. Let me just give a quick example, Audrey, that I'm thinking about is, I'm thinking back to when I was teaching fifth grade and I might give my students a math assessment, right? And I can remember this happening more than one time, right? And most of my students, as I'm cheering for them, as I'm grading their papers, most of them are unable to demonstrate understanding of a particular concept as I grade their papers. So there's kind of a choice that I have in that moment, right? Do I go back in class and say, nobody was paying attention, nobody was doing what they were supposed to be doing. Look, all of you did this particular level of achievement on this particular assessment. Instead of saying to myself, what did I do? What could I have done differently to provide more opportunity for my students to succeed? So Audrey, those are just really different mindsets of how to approach the work.
Yeah, it really is, Mark. And I appreciate that example, even of the test. And, you know, I definitely had times where one of my class periods would fail predominantly or not, you know, get very low scores collectively on a test. And it's not easy. It's not easy emotionally to take responsibility for that.
Right.
It's far easier to put the blame on someone else, right? And say, it's the kids. They weren't listening. Yeah. I knew it. Right. It's that after lunch crowd. They're so chatty. They weren't paying attention. Well, you know, and we go on and on and on. Instead of looking up and saying, you know, what's different here? What did I do differently? What could I have done differently? What other measures could I have considered? Did I know ahead of time that they weren't going to achieve on this? Because if I didn't, if I thought they knew what they were learning and I had all this other feedback that they were learning, then why am I holding this one test or this one assessment as different information from what they already know, right? So all those gotchas. I think there's a lot of spaces that we have inequities baked into our system, perhaps as a phrase in terms of if you think of us as a baked good, but like it's interwoven into how our system is creative. It's one of the threads that's woven into there is that we have inequities. And the author goes through a whole bunch of these. She spends time talking about inequities in personnel and their training and you know, success at teaching students, access to resources and technology, access to certain courses and classes, especially advanced ones when you talk about high school, inequities and budgets. Like, I think we would all like to think, it makes us feel good to think that there is not an opportunity gap. Because an opportunity gap says we did something that is setting certain students up for success and other students not up for success. And I think she brings up a whole bunch of examples from the COVID-19 pandemic that says, like, look, friends, we thought there was no problem with access to technology. And then the other shoe dropped. And all of a sudden, all of our kids need access to technology. And how many of them didn't?
Right.
How many of them we said, oh, yeah, they have something at home. And we're like, oh, but they don't. Or it highlighted other disparities. And so I think the opportunity gap shift and what you're talking about here shifts that onus, but also the ability to change something to us, which is both hard to swallow and empowering. So I'm super curious. Do you think we should even gap gaze? I love this phrase. Should we gap gaze at all? Should we even look at the opportunity gap, Mark?
Such a good question and such a good phrase to bring into the conversation, Audrey. We should let our readers know, our listeners know, if you're not reading along with us, you definitely need to jump to 127. At the top, there's an important quote by Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez. And I was so fortunate, Audrey, to hear Dr. Gutierrez talk about gap gazing, this whole phrase of gap gazing that she brought into the room when I heard her speak. And I have to say, I've been fascinated and disturbed at the same time about this phenomenon ever since that I heard her speak about this. And it's this notion that if we gaze at these gaps, these so-called gaps, if we look at this data and we continue, as you said a few minutes ago, like we're looking at this group, we're looking at this group, we continue to gaze at that gap, it actually has potential of reinforcing certain beliefs about a particular student group or student groups. And it's just such a powerful idea.
Yeah, it really is. And so how do we both acknowledge that there's a gap and not fixate on the gap, right? And instead fixate on the opportunities. I think it's super interesting. I heard a talk, you and I were in a room together. We heard like a clip from a talk that Jeff Duncan Andrade gave called The Game is Rigged and Equity by Design. And there were lots of key moments in that. I'm going to link it in the show notes because it's, I think, 4.5 minutes. And it is probably going to spur enough conversations to last you a month if you share it with your colleagues and really dive into it. Sure. But one of the things I just like to bring into this space is that he says every year we get our standardized data back and we act shocked because you have to. You have to act shocked. Even though we all know what the data is going to say, we act shocked because what's the alternative? What's the alternative to not being shocked? It's to actually acknowledging that we knew there were opportunity gaps,
right,
that were going to appear as achievement gaps. And so I think it's a super interesting idea, because I know as a math educator, I could look up year after year with whatever assessment system we had in place, and I could pretty well guess what the results were going to be coming back for my kiddos every year.
Yeah.
And I wasn't shocked by the data. And yet I would have principals or other administrators be like, look at this data. We got to do something. Like, and why wasn't I shocked? Why wasn't I disturbed by it? Like, I'd written off all the explanations for why someone hadn't done well in my class, as opposed to really thinking about that as a responsibility issue. And I get it. It's overwhelming to feel like we have responsibility to change this. It's a system-wide issue, and we are just one part of the system. But there's a tension there, right? Between knowing our system is designed to get these results and then actually getting those results and acknowledging what that actually means, right?
Yeah, that's, yeah, so well put. And Audrey, I concur. That is definitely a recommended viewing. So check that out in the show notes. So Audrey, if we just go ahead and play this out for a couple minutes with this idea of opportunity. So let's say we shift our language. We're not going to use achievement gap. We're going to use opportunity gap. Well, then we better start figuring out how we're going to create more opportunity too, right?
Yes, right.
So it's like, that's only the very beginning. It's an important beginning, but it's just the beginning. So let's play this out for a few minutes, because our author does mention some possibilities of things we might pursue to create more opportunity. And one of the ideas that the author mentions is this idea of either hiring math specialists at an elementary level or assigning a teacher to teach two or three sections of math, so to speak, in an upper elementary classroom. And Audrey, I think I might have mentioned to you that I was a math specialist at an elementary school.
Right.
Really interesting job. The model was that I was involved in was an additionally funded staff person. So I was brought in to just do that work. So I didn't have other responsibilities. I also was a math resource teacher at an elementary school that used an existing teacher to teach three classes of students' mathematics. And just real quick here, Audrey, I think it's worth noting that there's definitely pros and cons to this type of model and whether it really does create opportunity with students. So one of the things I've started to think about in this example, Audrey, is sort of like, how do we decide which of these change models is the thing that we should really implement? Because as you know, and lots of our colleagues that work with us work with people on trying to figure out, like, how do we know the change is really the change and we're not just getting to the solutionitis type of a mentality? So I think one of the things I just like to throw out there for our listeners is this idea of thinking about a viewpoint of how the decisions have impact on students first, and then consider the adults in the system. I think sometimes, because our job is so challenging and difficult, sometimes we go quickly to solutions that we think that might support us, and then in turn they'll support students. But I don't know that we always think first, like, how will this decision be in the best interest of students first? In my first school, Audrey, we were a school that constantly heard about this idea of achievement gap. It was just this mantra. It was like you know, many people, probably some of our listeners, experience where every summer it's you come back and you get the speech about the test scores and so forth. But one of the things that we did at that first school I worked at, there was an intentional shift to change the culture of the school and how we interacted with how we were going to decide what these changes were going to be to support our students. And here's what it was, Audrey. It was called the Comer model. And in the Comer model that we followed, there was a phrase we used every single time before we considered something new. And it was, all decisions made in the best interest of students. And so if somebody said, well, let's go ahead and have one teacher in charge of three classes with math, the idea would be, how is that decision going to be made in the best interest of the students? So, Audrey, I know that was a long time ago. It was something that came up for me and bubbled up. And I think it's important that we might consider that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. I appreciate the rephrasing and the, or not even rephrasing, but the refocusing on what matters. You know, it's interesting that you talk about this idea of being a math specialist, because I was something similar to that. I was a TOSA, which is more what it looks like at the secondary level. Mm-hmm. But we were funded for 3 years and then we weren't funded. And so there's this idea of like, there's support for a time. And then it almost reminds me of like, you know, like a water dam that's breaking and someone feels the first crack and they put their hand over it.
They
have to go after your two hands are used, they go move one of their hands to another crack. Right.
Right.
So 3 years was the number of years it took to say, oh, there's another crack in this wall and I'm going to go stick my hand in somewhere else. And so part of what I hear you almost asking when you think about every decision focuses back on being in the best interest of our students is that we have to at some point look up and say, I have two hands. I can hold these two cracks on the wall and, or this wall needs to be redone, right? Like I can't keep putting a hand over it and thinking if I move my hand that that's going to be in the best interest of the students, because I am removing a support in order to give a different support. And so I think that's one of the spaces that's, it's not an easy job to be an administrator and have a finite number of dollars and a finite number of teachers and a finite number of, you know, buildings and spaces and think about how to do that. And that's where I think we can do better as a group to support each other in making those decisions that are made in the best interest of our students. So I really appreciate that reframe, Mark.
Yeah, great points, Audrey. Well, here's something else that that our author did mention briefly, Audrey, that we should really get into. You know, our students with disabilities often become part of the gap gazing. They are one of those student groups that, again, we're not surprised by the data. So maybe it'd be worth talking for a couple minutes. Like, how do we create opportunities for them? And how can we reflect on how we've not served them well and use that thinking to shift into better opportunities?
Yeah, those are great questions. I don't have any answers. No. I wish I had answers that I felt like. I have things that we're trying and that we're thinking about. I guess is the best way I can say that. I don't really have answers. You know, some of the things we're thinking about is like, how do we leverage students' brilliance, all students' brilliance? And some of that has to do with whether or not we've segregated students in different classes or we've included them. And when we think about inclusion, then what support are we giving teachers to think about teaching all students? Because like you said earlier, in another example, if the only thing we do is we do an additive change, but we don't think about how it affects the whole part of the whole thing that's being changed, we haven't done much. We've also talked a lot about math IEP goals. Mm-hmm. And part of creating opportunity for students with disabilities is thinking about what we say their time and energy and focus is going to be spent on. And those IEP goals drive so much of the work that students are doing day in and day out. And if we don't rethink what we're asking them to spend the time on, we are not creating opportunity. We're sending them back into repeating over and over and over again. I remember hearing a colleague of mine whose own child is a student with a learning disability. And I remember him saying that he had just come out of a meeting with the IEP team and the counselor. Mm-hmm. And he had to look and say, like, I appreciate all the time and effort you've spent on putting together these goals, but when is my child supposed to catch up? Like, every year students are learning all of this. And every year you are only focusing my child's efforts on this small little section of stuff, right? So the gap is getting bigger and bigger. If we're going to focus on gaps, the gap is getting bigger and bigger in terms of the opportunity even afforded to them because of how those IEP goals are designed. So I think that maybe there's space there into both thinking about where are students with disabilities, how are they included and how is their brilliance shown, and how do we create opportunities through their IEP goals for them? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, well, about the first thing you talked about with our supporting our teachers, especially our special educators, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about, Audrey, is that, you know, we not only segregate our students, but we segregate our adults. Is we send our special educators to certain meetings, we send our general educators to other meetings. And, you know, one of the things that you and I tried right before the pandemic started is we had a professional learning opportunity where we had general educators coming with special educators that they worked with. And the thing that we experienced in that space is that some of these folks had never sat in a space together that was around mathematics thinking and learning. That was part of a professional learning opportunity.
Yeah.
So I just throw that out there, Audrey, that I think that that's some more work that I'm really interested in doing, is really allowing people really to be in a respectful space so that they can do the grappling and the thinking around the mathematics. And sometimes we segregate our special educators away from that.
Yeah, that's a great point. So we've talked about a shift there mm-hmm. between achievement gaps to opportunity gaps, whether we should spend time gazing at all. Let's talk about this next part, this last part of the chapter, which is like, so what can we, each one of us, do to challenge the opportunity gaps that exist? The author lists a whole bunch of ideas and bullets. Did any of them stick out to you?
Yeah, yeah, definitely, Audrey. One of them that stuck out to me is, I'll just read it from the text. Our author wrote, "Punching back against achievement gap rhetoric when you hear it." And so I think that's a worthy thing to have in the front of our minds. However, what I will say is, easy to say that you're going to do that, and a little harder to know like how you're going to do that. So something that does come to mind, because there are different parts of language as I engage with educators that I realize when somebody says something and it triggers for me. One of my triggers is low math students. But as I engage with people in professional learning settings, I realize that for me to just have a quick retort to somebody about, don't say low math students in my presence, it's not really going to be a way to start to move them along a journey. So I think one of the things that I've started to do is use a lot of I statements and say something like, when I get an opportunity, so I'm not putting somebody on the spot, but having a conversation with somebody and saying, you know, I stopped using the phrase low math students a little while ago, and this is why I stopped using that. I stopped using the phrase achievement gap a little while ago. This is why I did. And I've done this in small discussions and actually large discussions with groups. But I found it to be a helpful way to have the conversation, because I talk about my journey, why I stopped doing something, why I start doing something else, especially around language. And I found that I don't think it's perfect, Audrey. I need to keep improving, but I think it's a start in not, as we were talking before, like not just letting things go past and not taking that opportunity.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. I think that's the intent of the bullet. Like, the punching back sounds very aggressive. And I hear you saying, like, perhaps being super aggressive about, like, don't use that word anymore. Here's the new word. Like, mm-hmm. that's not going to be super productive. And I don't think that's her intent in using that language.
Yeah.
But instead, that we need to really be actively thinking about how we dismantle this rhetoric, right? And I appreciate your examples. One other example I can offer that's different, because you and I always approach and attack things differently. Attack maybe be too hard now. Now I realize my language. Look at my language myself. Okay. is this idea of a what else activity. So sometimes when I hear something like, these kids can't, or these kids, you know, look at their achievement, it's so awful. These kids just cannot perform. Like, instead of saying, you know, that's bad language, mm-hmm. don't do that, it's their opportunity, and trying to like win people over, I go into the space of like curiosity dreaming almost. Like, okay, that's one idea. One idea is that those kids can't. What else could have been the issue here? And let's spend 60 seconds, see how many other ideas we can come up with besides the fact that the kids can't. What else could have it been? Because I think sometimes our limitation is our own perspective, the narrowness of it. And when we pause and take time and think about all the other perspectives that might be present, we actually are very empathetic people in general, and we can think and acknowledge that there might be a different experience there, but sometimes we have to slow down and do that. And so what's the cost? We can't probably in that moment actually determine if the student can't, or if it was something else. So why not, you know, spend the time to acknowledge that by spending 60 seconds, 5 minutes, coming up with as many alternative ideas, and just realizing the problem might be more complex than what we're making it out to be.
Yeah, true. And I appreciate that, because then one idea doesn't drive the conversation, which, especially if it's a deficit idea, that makes a lot of sense. Audrey, there was one last bullet here that we have time to get into, is that the author includes right after the bullet we just mentioned, and it also resonated with me. Our author says, committing to raise awareness of inequities, not just when the situation becomes so dire that it can no longer be withstood, but always. Really, really a nice last bullet in her list. And actually, I was kind of getting to this a couple minutes ago with this idea of when, you know, when equities are brought to light, or even when we just get a hint of that there's an inequity somewhere, sometimes we say, well, let me wait till it's not really that big of a deal yet, or we might want to skip over it and think, oh, wait a second. No, that's a little too messy or too complicated. Or there's going to be some conflict around that. Maybe I might be uncomfortable with conflict. But, you know, thinking back to our previous season with Street Data, it just reminds me how, like, if it's messy, it's probably something that you need to tackle. And I think that there's a real pushback to just make things very black and white and keep it that way without really getting into the real equity work, which tends to be messy.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. And, you know, I loved in that book, Street Data, when they talk about it being a fractal problem, you know, like you can't answer that kind of a question with a simple answer. And it is messy. I think also, Mark, you know, you bring up this idea, you know, not just when it becomes so dire that it's, you know, emergency mode, but always. And I think this idea of being a squeaky wheel is a hard one. I think I understand that that's what gets fixed is the squeaky wheel, but I don't think anyone wants to be the squeaky wheel. Right. So like, if I'm always the person raising my hand saying, yeah, but what about, you know, right. I feel like we feel like we use up our talking chips or our talking tokens. And we're like, I can't bring it up again. I'm going to be labeled as that person and no one's going to listen anymore. Right. And yet if someone doesn't start, then there's never a chance for someone else to follow and join. And sure. So I think that I think these problems are important enough that we need to consider both being that first person to say something, the squeaky wheel, and thinking about how we leave space for others to be that wheel with us, I guess. And let there be a first follower to it, and let there, you know, be a space where other people say, I'm thinking that too. You know, like, I'm also noticing there's some squeakiness here. We need to think about this. So it's not an easy solution. It's complex, it's fractal, and it's messy. For sure.
Yeah. And the things that you're making me think of is that you and I have joined a couple of colleagues in a way of sort of how do we have a space to grapple with this messy work? And so what we've done is we formed a little equity chat group, and we're from different content areas, and we get together and we talk about the things that we've been trying to do in our day-to-day work. And we share those dilemmas with each other. We receive feedback from each other. We question each other a lot and ask for more information and ask for possible solutions. And Audrey, I just have to say that group has really helped me feel like I'm not alone in doing that work. And it gives me a lot of support. And I just look forward to bringing the things that are part of my day-to-day equity math work to that group. And I just thought I'd share that idea because maybe our listeners are looking for a possible model for that.
I appreciate that, Mark. Well, what a great episode, a chance for us to really think about the difference between attainment gap and opportunity gap. And I really appreciate the reframing around where we're going to offer opportunities for our students. So much to think about this episode.
I agree. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 9, Is the School System Broken? And we will continue to discuss how we dismantle harmful beliefs that hinder equitable mathematics education. Until then, best wishes on rewriting the story of math.